BBC presents Talking About Books.
Hello. This is Robin Holmes introducing Walter Allen, novelist and critic, and Richard Hoggart, author, sociologist, and lecturer, who'll exchange views on British books with utopian themes. Walter Allen will also introduce a recorded contribution from Aldous Huxley. Over then to you, Walter.
Thank you, Robin. Now, I suppose we get the word utopia straight from Thomas More, from Thomas More's book, don't we? And I suppose, I mean, we know that he was using the Greek word for nowhere or for no place. And I suppose as he used it, it wasn't merely to show that the place didn't exist, but there were ironical connotations, weren't there?
I should have thought so, yes. Of the kind, it would be rather nice if this could exist, but we have a shrewd suspicion it won't.
That human nature being such as it is, this can't happen.
Yes.
But the word has shifted its meaning, hasn't it? Utopia has come to stand for the highly desirable, if we can get it.
Yes.
And then it shifts again, I think, in quite recent years. Utopias are either being placed in space or remote in time. Mm. And perhaps our sense of time has telescoped. Utopias recently been put into the future, and because of that, the utopia has become the great bad place. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I think one could distinguish between the general popular use of the word, the one you mentioned first, that if you just said utopia in a conversation to a group of people, they would think of the great dream,
yes,
of all that's good, as you hinted, the thing over the hill that's always perfect. But if, as readers of books, critics, intellectuals, we think about modern books which are utopias, we at once think of those which describe bad utopias.
Yes, and this is something fairly new, isn't it?
I should have thought 20th century.
Yes. I think it myself, it begins with H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was a great utopian. He must have written almost a dozen books that can be called utopian in one sense or another. And it seems to me that right from the very beginning, Wells has this double view. I mean, some of his utopias, like Men Like Gods, are positive utopias.
Yes.
And in his first work of fiction, The Time Machine, you get hints of the negative utopia. Do you remember? I'm thinking of the of that terrible passage in the future where the descendants of the proletariat and the descendants of the aristocracy have, as it were, become quite split and have bred into different forms. And
yes,
the Morlocks, who are the descendants of the oppressed poor, live under the earth, blind, and the Eloi, the descendants of the aristocracy, have become effete, fairy-like, happy creatures who live on the surface of the world and exist in continual play, but are snatched from the earth's surface every so often as the food of,
yes,
the Morlocks. And that's a terrifying thing, it seems to me.
I agree. It occurs to me as an idea worth playing with that here, as in so many other things, Wells is a kind of hinge between the age of reason and hope and enlightenment, which, roughly speaking, died at the turn of the century, or perhaps just after, and the much more shocked and, in many ways, dispirited modern world. I mean that, very roughly, even though the utopias before the 19th century may have thought it unlikely that utopia would ever come about, they did remain basically hopeful, comic, rational, correcting people's manners by excess or laughter.
You were thinking of Swift, for example.
I'm thinking of Swift, yes. And I'm even thinking of Samuel Butler's Erewhon.
Which is nowhere backwards.
Yes. That they appear to be saying basically this, that society would probably never be as good as this, but if we talk to you as sensible, reasonable human beings, you'd probably move a bit that way. Now, if you jump Wells for the moment, because I said he was a hinge, go to the other side of the hinge and look at somebody we must talk about later, Huxley and Orwell, there you have this shocked facing of the possibility of a terrifying world. And it's arguable that in Wells, in his own life and in his own books, you can see the tug of the positive progressive.
Yes, well, this is most interesting, because there's that, what I think, wonderful piece of science fiction of Wells, The First Men in the Moon, which, if you remember, describes the inhabitants of the moon. They're ants, and their society is based entirely on function. As far as I remember, librarians are ants. The librarian ants have remembered all the books they've ever read and are put to sleep until they're wanted, until they're almost taken down from the shelves, And this now is terrifying, because one sees it as a vision of the complete totalitarian state. Yes. But when Wells wrote it 50 years ago, it couldn't have been like that at all. It couldn't have read like that. And I think that one assumes that Wells was terrified, but in fact I think that he was merely playing around with ideas.
I think this is true, yes, that in this sense it's aesthetic, Wells.
Yes.
That he's fascinated by projecting possibilities of scientific development without being closely related to the human weight, the human cost of them, because the human possibilities seem so remote. But if you take a modern person, as you say, these things are so near to us, we've got near to them more than once, that we're appalled by the cost in human terms.
Well, look, there's another hinge, surely, and that is Aldous Huxley. Now, when Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World, was he seriously contemplating a possible future, or was he playing around with ideas, would you say?
Oh, there's always bound to be an element of playing, because one loves playing with ideas anyway, but I think at bottom, no, he was deeply serious.
He was seeing a wholly conditioned world, a world conditioned by psychologists and sociologists and economists, wasn't he?
Yes, well, he wasn't saying, look, these things specifically will happen, but he was saying something of this order could very easily emerge. It wasn't just fun and games.
Yes. And then you remember, just after the war, after the atomic bomb, he produced another negative utopia, Ape and Essence.
Yes.
And that was truly horrifying, it seemed to
Indeed.
Me. I mean, so horrifying as to be almost, in a sense, unreadable, because unbearable.
Yes.
This picture of the human society and the human race after radio mutation and so on. And he's now written yet a third utopia. I interviewed him about it the other day, and perhaps we could hear from that now.
Well, thank goodness it's at last finished. It's I've been at work on it for a long time, with interruptions, and it's a utopian fantasy. It's an attempt to do the opposite of what I tried to do in Brave New World. In Brave New World, I tried to draw a picture of a society where a deliberate effort was made to iron out human differences and to create a standardized human product. In this society, which I postulated as existing in a tropical island somewhere between Ceylon and Sumatra, a serious effort is made to help the individual members of the society to realize as many as possible of their desirable potentialities. This is the essential difference. One is what may be called a negative utopia, and the other is a positive utopia.
What's the title, Mr. Huxley?
The title is simply Island. It is essentially an island. It's a contemporary fantasy. It's an island within our world, which certainly is not an ideal world. And the problem which I set myself was simply this. How do we implement our ideals? I mean, nothing is easier than to formulate ideals, but nothing is harder than to discover the means whereby those ideals may be put into practice. And what I've tried to do is, so to say, to write a practical utopia, a kind of cookery book of utopia, considering what would one do? I mean, if one wants, it's easy to say, for example, wouldn't it be nice if everybody were good and kind and intelligent? Yes, it certainly would be very nice. But what must we do in order to see that people shall behave well and kindly and intelligently? And this entails thinking about what you do in relation to the family life, what you do in relation to sexual life, what you do in relation to social organization and economics, what you do in relation to religion and to education. And I've tried to work this out as practically as I can.
This is, as it were, a vade mecum to the working good life.
Yes, this is essentially what I've tried to do.
The island is set in the east, you say.
Well, it's somewhere halfway between Ceylon and Sumatra.
Is there any significance in that?
Well, there is indeed, because what I've tried to bring together in the island is the two traditions of the east and the west. Let me give a little description of how this island lies and what its relation to the outer world is. There are two islands in this area, divided by a narrow strait. One of the islands happens to have a magnificent harbour and has therefore constantly been overrun during the centuries by foreign invaders. The other island, which is my island, which I call Pala, has no harbour and has never presented any temptation to people. Well, the result is that whereas the other island was overrun first by the Arabs, then by the Portuguese, then by the Dutch, then by the English, and was then given its freedom, say, 15 years ago, and is now, of course, under a military dictatorship, and is exploited by oil companies. This, my island, was never overrun and remains what Java was several hundred years ago, a Mahayana Buddhist island with Shivaite overtones, and owing to a number of historical accidents, which I've explained, this island has, for about 100 years, combined Western and Eastern influences in an attempt to use the variable factors in our scientific approach to life and in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition of the spiritual and psychological approach to life. And I've tried to see what would happen if you made the best of both worlds.
Well, from Huxley's description of his own forthcoming utopia, it looks as though there we are back in with the rationalist utopia, doesn't it?
Very much so, yes.
Which is wonderful to think of, comparing that with, shall we say, Orwell's 1984, which surely is the most terrifying of the whole lot, isn't it?
Yes. There's one thing that occurs to me straight away. It's going to be extremely interesting to see what a mind like Huxley's does with the whole business of trying to plot the good life from the assumption that you have an area, an island of peace. And
yes.
This is fine. And then when one thinks of 1984, one remembers that Huxley says that his island is the one that, because of artificial factors, has been kept
isolated.
Yes. And one wonders about the other island that has got the harbour. I mean, this is 1984 again, that we are in a situation for as long as we can see where our whole nature of the good life is being pulled by the nose by the fact that we're in a state of conflict. You see what I'm driving at, that we're hardly at the point even of considering the good life within an island environment, because even though we're officially at peace, we're in fact torn by divisions, and these
yes.
are the things that Orwell projected.
Well, now, what now, after the gap of 10 years since it was published, do you think of 1984? Do you think it is still terrifying? Do you think it is still a really salutary warning?
Yes, I do. I'd like not to think that, but I read it again recently, and I still find it terrifying. I still have the doubts I had before, but which are chiefly that I don't think Orwell, for whatever reason, gives sufficient weight to human resilience, human gaiety, human courage, all kinds of things like that. Nevertheless, the basic projection of a society in which outside forces, in this case the world being divided, interlocked between three powers which are permanently in a state of near war, if not actual war, and the pressures that puts upon the nature of the society in education, in indoctrination and all that kind of thing, these seem to me to be, especially at this point in 1961, a bit too near for comfort.
Yes. And I'm always haunted by that dreadful image with which the book ends, or very nearly ends, the image of the boot on the face forever, yes. Doesn't or will yes. say.
If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot grinding a human face forever.
Yes, that's it. But one thing, of course, comes up. We've been talking about utopias as pictures of the desirable society or the undesirable society or of possible futures, but there's always, even in 1984, the element of satire, isn't there? I'm thinking about in 1984 with the satire on the use of on language, yes. For example.
Yes. That's true. I should have thought that in 1984 the element of satire was less than the element of sheer shock.
Yes.
And horror. You can be satirical or ironic better if you've got a basic assumption that although human beings will never be perfect, they'll jog along perhaps getting a bit better, and I think Orwell had lost this.
Yes. Well, it's interesting to jump backwards from Orwell's vision of the future after a great war to an earlier vision, in a book called Tom's a Cold. I don't know whether you ever read it, by John
No.
Collier. It was published in 1933, and Collier sets his book in England, in an England, in 1995, after England has been devastated by many years of war. Modern war, obviously, but not atomic war. And he says himself in his preface that there are no sociological implications at all. And what in fact is done at the end is to produce a kind of pastoral of intelligent, civilized people living in small communities in a fairly primitive way and having to contend against nature. And the general effect in some strange manner is to remind one of As You Like It,
yes.
Do you see?
Yes.
And this seems to me to be the aesthetic utopia.
You call it aesthetic because he's enjoyed imagining
it. He's enjoyed imagining it, and it isn't meant to be an awful warning. It has no admonitory finger-shaking, which most modern utopias have.
Yes.
Now, there's one question I'd like to put to you, Richard, and that is it possible, do you think, for a utopian novel, a novel about the future or about an ideal past or an ideal future, is it ever possible for it to be a good novel?
On the whole, I would doubt it, and I wouldn't expect it to be. I wouldn't ask it to be, chiefly because I think whatever else my novel, as I would define it, has to do is to present human beings in relationships, personal and social, which I can recognise as real, not because I recognise the lampposts in a street in 1961, but because I recognise that these are connected with issues and situations that happen to human beings, even if we're talking about 18th century Russia. Now, if the eye of the author is on a projection, a whole inventive projection into a new social order, then either he will forget the character presentation, or if he tries it, I think the two will fight with one another. You will get interested in the exploration of character and forget that it's in 2020.
Yes, but in the end, judging utopian fiction as utopian fiction, that doesn't matter.
No, not a bit.
Well, books like 1984 and Brave New World, and I assume Huxley's forthcoming book Island, are, as it were, cosmic utopias, aren't they? They take
yes.
in the whole world, and they are, in a sense, fundamental. They're books about life and death, or life or death. But is there any scope now, do you think, for the, as it were, the limited utopia? The utopia that, shall we say, accepts the the premise that the world is going on much as it is now and looks into the future.
I wonder if the book by Michael Young, which came out about 2 years ago, is the sort of thing you're thinking
of. The Rise of the Meritocracy?
Yes. Because if you remember, in that, he was talking only about England, and he was setting his sights chiefly on internal social changes in England. And what he said was that our society is becoming so geared to the notion of selection by skills, by function, having got rid of its old class selections by accident, that if we go on like this, we shall become so committed to this kind of selection and to this kind of organized functional society that in the end we shall have a society, and then he projected it far beyond what it had ever become for the sake of argument, we shall have a society in which at the age of, say, 9, by scientific tests, you were discovered to be a C-plus person, and the range of occupations open to you was street sweeper to office cleaner. You were then told that this was the happiest of all jobs, and you did it very happily. And then at the age of 20, you had another test, and if your IQ had risen, you were shifted again. The whole thing was organized in that way. Now, Young kept his eyes solely on a piece of social irony.
Yes.
Because what he wants to do is to get the English to start looking at education for human beings, not just for functions within society. And when one read that, in a way, one was delighted, because it's really a clever book and a funny book. And at the same time, one felt a vague feeling of almost guilt that it was an 18th century tract, in that the kinds of utopia, of anti-utopia, suggested by Huxley and Orwell seem so overridingly pressing upon us that one wondered what room there was for this play by Michael Young.
Yes. And surely there's the interest, too, of here as a man who's a professional sociologist, in a sense satirizing some of the things that a good many of us rather take for granted in sociologists.
Yes, it was a nice relief to see him taking the mickey, as we say, taking a rise out of his own people.
Yes. As one of the great positive utopias, of course, is, or two of them rather, William Morris's The News from Nowhere and A Dream of John Bull. Mm-hmm. And they stem out of a positive, idealistic belief in the future of socialism. And they are, in a sense, I suppose, typical 19th century works, aren't they?
Yes, I should have thought that we come back to Wells and the Hinge again, that was about the last point at which any person could be as openly positive in a utopia.
But do you think, what do you think was the effect of those books of Morris and in America of a writer like Edward Bellamy with his Looking Backward? What was the effect on readers? My impression is that Morris, particularly in this country, had a great influence on many of the early socialists. And when I say early socialists, I mean the people who joined the Independent Labour Party, for example, in the end of the 19th century.
I'm sure he did, and I spent 12 years teaching classes of adults all over the provinces, and I remember a lot of them who had enormous optimism given to them by reading Morris. Now, my own attitude was a bit different. I admired Morris enormously, and I couldn't but feel the human decency of his capacity to inspire people like that. On the other hand, and this is perhaps something to do with the whole business of being a human, I think it's true to say, and my experience with Morris bears it out, that one tends to be much more impatient of a positive utopia than of a negative utopia. I mean that one can take the lesson from and nod wisely and with interest at a utopia which says things are going to be as horrible as this, but one gets terribly suspicious when somebody starts doing as a blueprint for the good world. It's rather like the old saying that the hardest thing in a novel is to
create the good man.
Create the good man.
Yes, but is this something relatively new I mean, is all this the result of our own experience of the world in the last 25 years?
I should have thought that it preceded that. And if you think back to Moore or even Swift, were there, or even Butler, were they defining their good society? They're at their best, and in fact, most of the time they're doing this. But they're at their best, certainly, not when they're trying to say, in the good society, they positively did this. That is to say, they danced between 12 and 2 every afternoon,
yes,
and drank tea. But in the good society, they did not do that.
Ah, yes, I see what you mean.
You've got to leave a hole for the imagination to fill.
Yes. Well, it suddenly strikes me that there is possibly another kind of utopian fiction coming into existence, although, again, it goes back to Wales in a sense. What do you think of the notion that a good deal of science fiction is really utopian?
I think it is. I don't much like the present craze for science fiction, but when I read it and choose those books that I'm told are the best, I find very often that they are a form of fascinated utopian writing, usually about the kind of society which will emerge when science has had its head. And they're not disreputable as that.
Well, I think this could lead us to some kind of generalization at the end. The science fiction writers are not trying, as Orwell and Huxley are, to warn us, are they?
No.
Would you say they fall into my category of the aesthetic utopia? The utopia which is simply a play of ideas, the author having, yes, having fun with possibility.
Yes, I think I would, and I think that's probably a very useful first distinction in talking about utopias at all. If one says, what does one mean by a serious attempt at a utopia, one should mean, I think, first of all, that the author has not set out simply to exercise his invention for its own sake and for the reader's amusement. Therefore, one means that the author has tried to be reformative. And then when you've got those, and that includes everything from Moore to George Orwell in one bag, those are the utopian novels, then you can subdivide them into those which assume that on the whole human society will go on and will be fairly well all right, but could do with a lot of reformation.
Yes.
And the others, which begin with a rooted horror at the thought that human society may very well destroy itself altogether. And these are the 20th century ones.
Yes. Well, I must say that I, for one, look forward to the time when it'll be possible for writers to produce utopias that describe the great good place.
And I should look forward with you, because when we reach that point, it will mean that we've got out of this state of frozen shock at the possibilities now apparently before us.
Well, I'm sorry to have to bring this discussion to a close, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. Thank you, Walter Allen and Richard Hoggart. And now this is Robin Holmes saying goodbye from the BBC in London.